Okay, the topic for this session will be evolution. Evolution. We're going to be talking about the problem of origins. Where have things come from? Where have we come from? Where has the world come from? When you talk about origins, there are certain things that you have to keep in mind. Number one is that all origins are unprovable by nature. They are not open to scientific investigation. When I say unprovable, I mean in the empirical or the scientific sense. They are not open to investigation because no one was there. They have happened in the past, and they are not open to observation anymore. Past events constitute history, but not science. You can work with a past event on the basis of historical investigation, but not on the basis of science. For instance, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. When people say, well, it's just unscientific to say that Jesus was raised from the dead. You say, well, yes, that's right. It is unscientific. As a matter of fact, it doesn't fit the realm of science at all, the idea that Jesus was raised from the dead. It's an historical event, and the only criteria you can use to try to show that that event actually took place is historical criteria, not scientific. Because it's not open to observation. It's a one-time thing that happened. It's not going to happen again, at least not with that person. It's not going to happen again. And so it is not open to observation. You can't repeat it in a laboratory. There are no controls you can place on it. It isn't open to scientific investigation. So the only thing that you can use then is historical criteria that you would use for any historical event. Well, the point is, the historical criteria that we'd use for any historical event, the major one is eyewitness. Right? Basically, what is history based on? It's on those who were there to be able to write down some kind of record or leave some record behind of an event that took place. Right? Right? Sometimes we have some kind of record that happened not as an historical event, but as a historical event in the sense of a cataclysm or whatever, and we've got some kind of evidence of that in stone without having a human witness, necessarily, like the flood. We have that. We'll talk about the flood. For historical events, such as the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, or the beginning of all things, those don't fit into the realm of scientific observation. They don't fit at all. And so it's an historical event, and we have to judge it on the basis of historical criteria. Now, there were no eyewitness accounts. There couldn't have been any eyewitness accounts of the creation. Couldn't have happened. Okay? Because we weren't there, right? Even according to what the scripture says, we didn't come along until the sixth day. According to what evolutionists say, we were a long ways behind everything else. And so, the only realm it fits in is history, and we have to deal with it in that regard. So when the scientist says that he is trying to show scientifically how things came about, then we do have to point out to him that he really cannot state how an origin took place scientifically. Because it is not open to observation at this point. And so it does not fit in the realm of science. And he is speculating, and he can try to use historical criteria, but there were no eyewitnesses at that time. So all origins are unprovable by nature in the scientific sense. All past events are history, fit in the realm of history, and not science, if they're particular one-time events. And the origins of the universe are not open to observation, so they don't fit the realm of science, only history. Okay, now all theories of origin are supernatural. They have to be. All theories of origin are supernatural. For instance, the idea that something came from nothing is supernatural. Because even according to the definition of the word nothing, you can't get something from nothing. As I said before, in the lecture before, it's even bad grammar, much less bad science. So the idea that something came from nothing would be a supernaturalistic idea. The Big Bang is a supernaturalistic idea because it defies the idea of entropy. Number three, the pulsating universe, the idea that the universe has always existed and has been going up and down in its level of energy, and that entropy has been operating forwards and backwards. Through the history of the universe, still is a supernatural idea. Why? Because as we observe the natural order, entropy appears to be operating. It's very obvious that entropy is operating, one of the most well-attested physical laws. And we don't have any evidence that it could go the other direction. And so it is a supernatural idea that the universe could be pulsating. And then number four, the idea of creation by God is a supernatural theory. Now, isn't it interesting? In the Bible, we have an eyewitness account by the only one that was around to be an eyewitness at the time, and that was God. And so all origins, because they're supernatural, they're unprovable by nature, they're not open to observation, all origins are a matter of faith. You're going to have faith in something along the way. All origins are a matter of faith. You must believe something along the way. Or to put it another way, they're all a matter of presupposition. You have to presuppose something somewhere along the way. Whether you're presupposing that matter is eternal, which is supernaturalistic, or you're presupposing that God created the universe, it's still a matter of faith. You are presupposing something without any evidence whatsoever, and that I would call faith. Or a form of faith. Now, the reason most naturalists find creation incredible is not because of science, but because of presupposition. Most naturalists find creation incredible, unbelievable, not because of science, but because of their presupposition. It's because the presupposition that there is an infinite personal God, in other words, supernaturalism, is objectionable to the person on grounds that are philosophical, not scientific. And so the person usually rejects creation. It's like one guy said, when he started to scrap evolution, a scientist that was an evolutionist said, "I can't accept the idea of evolution anymore. But the only other philosophical alternative is so objectionable that I cannot accept it either." And what he was talking about was creation. And so he didn't even approach the idea of creation on the basis of science, totally on the basis of philosophy. Okay? But he knew that scientifically evolution wasn't valid. And yet he said, "I can't accept the opposite alternative, the other alternative of creation, because it's just blatantly ridiculous." Okay? And so they don't reject it on the basis of science, but on the basis of their presupposition. You find that very frequently with lots of different things, that people are not rejecting something because it doesn't make any sense scientifically or in reality, but because they simply don't accept the presupposition. Now, the difference between... what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through this lecture and point out a number of different things, but I'm not going to hit any of them in great depth. Any one of these, we could spend weeks or months on any one thing. You could talk about origins for months and the philosophical aspects of origins. I'm going to hit little things like this and get your thinking started, and then you're going to have a lot of work to do in following those things up by good books, going to lectures, talking with people, so forth. In evolution, the difference between evolution and creation is the difference between what is called uniformitarianism and catastrophism. Uniformitarianism says this: uniformitarianism says that all the processes that are now operating in the creation or in the world, all the processes that are now operating can explain all of the things in the past. That was basically Lyell's statement, but can explain everything of the past. And it has all been happening as a slow process of development, but everything has basically been uniform. All the process, there have been little exceptions here and there, a volcano sputs out here and there or something like that. Little exceptions here and there, but they would even include that as part of the natural process, part of the uniformity of the universe. But the idea is this, is that everything has started out in a lower state and has gradually gone to higher order, all by the principles that we see operating in the world today. Now, creation and the idea that's in the Bible is not that things are uniform, but that things started out in their best state, and through a series of catastrophes have gone down from there, with little tiny swings up every now and then, in civilization, or usually in civilization. And then the major points where things started to go downhill, have been judgments of God on the earth or on people or both. So the idea then is that in creation, in the Bible, is that everything started out in its best state and has been going down from there. Whereas in evolution, it says that everything started out in chaos and has been going uphill from there. So they are diametrically opposed to one another. Yeah, this is catastrophism, saying that there were major catastrophes. Now, a lot of people don't realize that there, because they don't read their Bibles too carefully, that there are more than seven major worldwide catastrophes that are mentioned in the Bible. The flood is only one of them. And that is because they read their Bibles with their poetic blinders on, rather than just reading the Bible for what it says, and trying to interpret according to good hermeneutical principles, which you should have some since Carol spoke on that. Right? Whether or not you're using them yet is another question, but you at least have them down on your little piece of paper. What we have to do is look at the Bible and read it according to good hermeneutical principles and see if we have any reason to say that this word means anything other than what it says. If it says a certain word, like God said he was going to bring judgment on the whole earth at the time when Egypt was judged, is there any reason to believe that he didn't judge the whole earth? See? There's no basis in the context of that statement to say, well, what he meant by that was just the area around Egypt. See? He said he was going to bring judgment on the whole earth. And there were many, many judgments that were like that, where God brought judgment on the entire earth, but we don't read our Bibles carefully like that. See? It's like the problem with, the Bible says God overturns the mountains in his anger. How do we explain strata that are completely opposite to the other strata that are around them on the basis of God's anger? Couldn't have happened gradually, or as one person put it, on the basis of God's thumb and forefinger. God got angry and went. You see? It says he overturns the mountains in his wrath. See, we read these things poetically and we think that, well, see, it says when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, and they were wandering in the wilderness, it says the mountains skipped like rams before them. What does that mean? Before the God of the whole earth. That meant that the mountains were jumped. There was a lot of geological activity when the people were wandering in the wilderness. No wonder the people around were scared to touch them. No wonder the woman, Rahab, said, our hearts have melted because we've seen what's happened, we've heard what's happened in Egypt and out in the wilderness. No wonder they said their hearts had melted with fear and there was no strength left in any person. See, because the children of Israel wandering around the wilderness, the mountains are jumping. Mm-hmm. Not only that, there was a rock that followed them around in the wilderness. And water came out of it. Now, isn't that interesting? Every time you turned up to a certain campsite, there was this rock. And you go to the next campsite and the rock's there too. You see? And it says the rock followed them around in the wilderness. That's interesting. Yes, in some natural way. Huh? And so we have these great worldwide catastrophes, like when the children of Israel went into captivity to the Babylonians. God said that he was going to bring judgment on the entire earth, and that there would be an earthquake that would make the entire earth reel like a drunken man to and fro in its orbit. Okay? There were the great things going on when the children of Israel, when they were attacked by Babylon, there were things happening all over the whole world at the same time. But we don't read those things very carefully. Another thing that affected the entire earth was the time when Joshua told the sun and the moon to stand still. That affected the whole earth. You know, what did God do with the whole universe to get that to happen? If things weren't thrown off. There's an interesting explanation of that the earth didn't actually stop, but what happened was that the earth, instead of spinning this way, flipped so that it started spinning this direction, so that the path went like this. And then went back into its path. An interesting idea? Because there are a lot of scientists who think that the earth may have been flipped at one point in its history. And that was also part of the being thrown off at 23 degree angle or whatever. Anyway, whether or not, I don't know. The Bible says there were seasons at the time of Noah, so I would conclude that there was a tilt in the earth at that point. Okay. Interesting things you get into when you get into this biblical stuff. Lots of stuff to satisfy your mind. And so these major catastrophes then took man downhill. And we'll see some things later of the superiority of ancient man. That man, before, was superior to what we are now. And I believe he was even superior technologically than what we are now. And I think that's why we get things like in Egypt, paintings with people on the earth and others in the sky, in boats, upside down with things around their heads. In reference to the earth, they are upside down. Yeah. Possibility that maybe the Egyptians knew about walking in space. Okay. So that doesn't bother me. When you read the Bible, it doesn't bother you to think of something like that. You know why? Because when you think into the past, if you think down, and if you think more primitive, you have evolution stuck in your head. Not the Bible. You go, oh, a little more evolution stuck in my head than I thought. If you think down and more primitive, when you think into the past, you've got evolution stuck in your head because the Bible says that man was created in a perfect state, in his best state, and he's gone downhill from there. And so a lot of people see, if you see Noah making the ark with primitive tools, you know, a piece of rock strapped to a hatchet, you've got evolution stuck in your head because the Bible says there was a man alive at the time who could make anything out of metal. Anything out of metal. And so Noah wasn't working with any kind of primitive tools when he was building the ark. So if you think more primitive when you think into the past, you've got evolution stuck in your head. You should think up when you think into the past. Man was better, knew more. Job said the ancients were wiser than we. Okay? He knew that the farther back you go, the smarter people were. Okay? Now there have been some catastrophic times when great amounts of knowledge have been lost, but that is what has happened. Great amounts of knowledge have been lost, and little bits of it have been recovered here and there. And eventually the society was judged again. Great amounts were lost, and then a little bit was recovered later. See, we may have recovered a little bit of technology in recovering laser and things like electronics and stuff. That we recovered a little bit of technology, but think of the things they may have had in the past. Somebody once said, if they were so smart. Well, I mean, why don't we see evidences of cars and things like that in the fossils and so forth? And say, well, if they were so smart, they wouldn't have made anything like cars that pollute the environment, use fossil fuels that aren't dependable. If they were that smart. Okay, so then, do you think up or do you think down when you think into the past? Do you think up or down? And many, many of Earth's structures, geologically, cannot be explained with uniformitarianism. For instance, there are large things that are called overthrusts. That's what, I believe that there are such things as real overthrusts, but there are, see, an overthrust is like this. It's when you've got a piece of material, I'll just draw it this way, in the Earth's structure, the crust, has broken. See, this was originally connected here. Got that? And it is broken. It's slid up over the other section for some reason, due to tectonic movement or plates moving or some whatever, or earthquake or something like that. You've got this movement of one over the other. But there will always be some kind of evidence right here that this has happened. Right? You get movements like that, you get those kind of things. But there are large structures that are called overthrusts, and the reason they're called that is because the layers here are a repeat of the layers that are down here. So they're out of order as far as timing is concerned, if you're looking at it from an evolutionary point of view, where things were laid down, layers were laid down little by little, one on top of another by sedimentation over long periods of time. Okay, so these are out of order then because there's a repeat of those. Sometimes they're upside down, which is rather interesting. Sometimes they're mixed together, which is also interesting. They don't tell you about that in most classes, biology, especially not in eighth grade. Okay, another really interesting thing is Z-shaped strata. Have you seen that? You don't see these things. They don't tell you about these. Strata that are like that. They're Z-shaped, and there's no evidence whatsoever that they weren't laid down like that. Now, that can't happen according to uniformitarian principles because in reference to the surface of the earth, which way will strata be laid down because of gravity? parallel to the surface of the earth. They have to be, according to gravity. Why do we get this then? What that indicates is that it was soft, and it was moved while it was soft, and then it hardened in that shade. See? Which indicates a flood, and not great long periods of time that it was where it was laid down over billions of years or whatever. Okay, but you get things like this. I think it's even here. Isn't the Lewis overthrust in Washington State? Yeah. I mean, there are, I believe it's thousands of square miles that are called an overthrust. And there is no evidence whatsoever along here where there should be evidence. There's no evidence that that has actually happened. And there are all kinds of fanciful theories that have been proposed as to how that happened. It was carried on water. And, of course, those kind of things, if it can be carried on water, you have to have some kind of self-contained unit for the water, because if the pressure can go out the sides, it's obviously not going to float anything if the pressure can go out the sides, which, in most cases, that would be the case. I don't know that they can explain any way that there could have been, it could have been held in on the sides while it was moving. But anyway, so you get things like that that cannot be explained. Small overthrusts can be explained when you've got the evidence there that the things were moved. Okay? Large overthrusts like that that have no evidence in here that something was moved cannot be explained by uniformitarian principles. Can be explained by a worldwide flood when those things were laid down and moved all within the period of a year when everything was still soft. Can be explained by that. I think it's most interesting what has happened at Mount St. Helens, that the if you see pictures of the strata that were laid down and have been eroded, if you don't see a person standing in them to see that they're only about 40 to 100 feet deep, the place looks like the Grand Canyon. All the strata looks just like the Grand Canyon, but it's happened within a period of about 2 or 3 years. Okay. But the thing is, if you see a person standing in it, it's, to give you some relative size, then you see that it's anywhere from 40 to 100 feet deep. It's not as big as the Grand Canyon. But to have that happen in 3 years is surprising a lot of geologists that it happened like that. Or that there are, they found trees at the bottom of Spirit Lake that are, they've taken pieces of wood that are coal on one end and grayed down to wood on the other. They're testing the different places, which means what? Coal did not happen over billions of years, but it could happen in one blast by a volcano. And the trees were many of them were placed at, like a forest, standing straight up in the bottom of the lake. And they're covered with water now, and logs. And they're standing straight up, looking as if they were there to start with, but they weren't. They were placed there by the blast as the thing washed the water out of the lake, and the water came back down the mountainside, and things were placed straight up and down in the lake, which shows that coal stands where we see trees that seem to be coal that are standing could have been made by a catastrophe just like the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Okay? Given something like the flood, no problem. You've got all the energy that's necessary to cause that kind of thing. But see, those things cannot be explained by uniformitarian principles. So you got mountains that are upside down in reference to the strata that are around them. You got like this. You got like that. And how's that explained in a uniformitarian way? How do you explain that it gradually was turned upside down? You can't do that. Okay? But God explains that. He says he overturns the mountains in his wrath. And things like fossils. Fossils cannot be explained according to uniformitarian principles, especially some of the fossils we have discovered. Okay? As a human race, we have discovered certain things that are just total enigma, like clams fossilized to the cellular level. How did that happen slowly? You leave a clam sitting on your counter for a few hours, and you know what happens? It starts to break down. Okay? Even if you cover the clam in certain ways, if you did it in a natural fashion, the clam is still going to rot if it's dead. Okay? But to say that it was fossilized down to the cellular level, which is really interesting, that whole idea. I'd love to see some of the specific data on the cell, the whole idea of the cells being fossilized and stuff, but see what they have to say about it. I've only heard about the general thing. But if it's been fossilized down to the cellular level, it had to have happened quickly. Had to have happened quickly. Couldn't have happened slowly. Otherwise, it spent an awful long time maintaining its cells in store while it was being fossilized over a period of a million years or whatever. Okay? Now, the principle of cause and effect is a problem here, because what we observe going on in the universe is that the cause is always greater than the effect. We work on the basis of that all the time. The cause, both practically and scientifically, we work on that basis. The cause is greater than the effect. Evolution says that the cause is less than the effect. It says that a whole lot of time plus a whole lot of matter and energy in motion, if you want to say it in a fancy way, plus a whole lot of chance equals a human being. Which means that something which is impersonal plus something which is impersonal plus something which is impersonal equals it. My problem is these two don't go together, you see. That is to say that the human being is personal and has come from the impersonal is to say that the cause is less than the effect, because the cause is impersonal, but the effect is personal. And so, in considering ultimate cause for everything that is, including human beings, evolution says that the cause is less than the effect. Whereas in creation, we would say the cause is greater than the effect. And so philosophically, in that respect, creation makes much greater sense. To say that an infinite personal God has created personal beings who are like him, only on a smaller scale, makes perfect sense. It does not make sense to say that that which is impersonal has produced, by chance, something which is personal, that makes choices. Okay? That doesn't make sense in the philosophical idea. Now, the problem of design. Before we take a break here, we'll talk about the problem of design. There is design in the universe. Actually, as C.S. Lewis pointed out, it's not the idea that there is a whole lot of chaos and a little bit of design that bugs us, but that everything has a design. And it so overwhelms us that everything is in some kind of pattern and order, right down to its, as we would call it today, its molecular or atomic level or even subatomic level, that everything has order and design to it. And it's difficult to find anything that's chaotic. And so what we do is we become, this is what C.S. Lewis said, we become so overwhelmed by all of this design that we have to, in order to protect ourselves, we have to conclude that it is not true and that the order is really chaos, and then we go around looking for design, but we won't really find any because we're looking for design in the midst of what we're calling, a design that we're calling chaos. You get the idea? Everything has design, and we start calling it chaotic because we can't handle all of that design pressing in on us going, there's a God, you know, some evidence that the supposition that there's a God would be true. We can't handle it. And so what we do is we flip over to the other side and say everything is chaotic, and then we look in the midst of all this design, which we are calling chaos, we look for some kind of design, which what we'd really have to be looking for is chaos, and it's not there. Okay? And so we think then that there isn't any design because we can't handle the idea that everything has design. But there's the problem of complexity in the human, especially in the human being. But let's take the one cell. In order to produce one functioning cell, now this is going to be giving evolutionists an awful lot of credit. Okay? But in order to produce one functioning cell, for the first amino acids to come together, or to be formed, and then for them to come together to form the first proteins, and then for those things to come together to form the first cell, which is really rather interesting because when you get down into DNA, you have to have proteins to make DNA, and you have to have DNA to make proteins. They're dependent upon one another, and if they didn't both come about at the same time, they couldn't have come about. And yet what they're saying is that proteins came about and somehow produced DNA, but the proteins came about without DNA. Okay? So they've got to explain how these amino acids got together and formed proteins without any DNA to start with. Okay? It's very difficult to explain because it takes DNA to form proteins. Okay, so the first amino acids coming together, forming proteins, and then forming the first cell. If you were to take one evolution per second, positive evolution per second. Now that's stretching it a bit. No evolutionist would ever say that one positive evolutionary jump is happening every second in the universe. But if you took one every second, there would not be enough seconds in the history of the universe, that is, given that the universe is 10 billion years old, there would not be enough time in the history of the universe for the first cell to have formed. With a positive evolution every second, because cells are that complex. You couldn't, with one every second. Can you imagine that? One, two, three, four, five, six. Positive evolutionary thing happening every second. In 10 billion years, you don't have enough to... Okay, so then to get everything together in that time, it isn't even possible in 10 billion years to put a cell together, much less a human being to have developed from that cell. A lot more to go besides that. See? So here's a problem. Remember we talked about entropy? That everything is running downhill? In a system where entropy is operating, more time does not help you, it hurts you. And yet the evolutionists have been constantly stretching the time of how long they think the universe has existed, and in some cases hoping that that will save their theory. Hoping that that will somehow save the theory of evolution. Of course, see, most people these days say evolution is not a theory, it is a fact. The theory of evolution is how it happened, not that it happened. And so you might run into that sometimes, so it's good for you to know that. You say, well, the theory of evolution, now it's not a theory. The theory is only how it happened. But you can point out to the person, that may be the way you look at it, but I don't know that I quite accept that yet. Okay? Don't be intimidated by that. So more time is not a help but a problem, because the longer something sits, the greater the entropy will be in that system and the less possibility there is that anything will happen within the system that is going to be of any benefit to the system. For instance, there's called the chemical equilibrium of solutions. And this is one of the arguments that A.E. Wilder Smith uses in some of his books as a pharmacologist, with a string of degrees behind his name about as long as your elbow, you know, from your elbow to your hand. He says that if a solution sits for a long period of time, the longer it sits, because of entropy operating, the longer it sits, the less likely it is that anything will happen of any note in that solution. That the longer something sits, the more likely it is that the chemical reactions that would have taken place have taken place. You get the idea? So then it's less likely the longer it sits. So if you have a primordial earth in which there is all this primordial soup, as they speak of it, in which these amino acids and so forth may be getting together to form proteins, the longer the period of time that you have, the less likely it is that anything would happen. And yet what they try to push over on us is the idea that give me more time and anything could have happened. And that's not true. Give me more time and less would happen. It's not true that more could happen if you have more time. It's true that less would happen if you have more time. So give them more time, and they hang themselves. And then what some people have said is that they've proposed this idea in evolution called punctuated equilibrium. Which is that the equilibrium of evolution is that there are slow changes taking place, which are very difficult to show, if at all possible. And then every now and then, there has been a rapid change from one thing to the next. Now, that used to be called, and has been rejected, it used to be called the hopeful monster theory. And it was rejected because there was no process that we can find genetically, chemically, physically. There's no process to say that you're going to have something like a bird laying an egg, or a reptile laying an egg and having a bird come out. You see? Everything genetically and physically is geared against that. That whole thing. You see? Any kind of change like that. And so, in order to preserve animals as they are. And so, it used to be called the hopeful monster theory, now it's called punctuated equilibrium. It's a nice name, but it's still the same thing. The idea being that radical changes happen very quickly. And whether they say, well, it happened because of inbreeding in a particular area that was isolated by such and such a phenomenon, it makes no difference. The genetics do not allow for that kind of rapid change from one animal to another. And so, and with the chemical equilibrium and solutions, you have the problem of more time. And then you also have, we'll take as our last little thing here because it's a lot of fun, that is, you also have what are called in common terms, right-handed and left-handed molecule. That is, when you have a chemical reaction, you will have atoms that arrange themselves in the molecules, but they can go two different directions according to the bonds that they will make. They can go this way, or they can go this way. So you can have A, B, C, D, E together as a molecule, or you can have A, B, C, D, E. And these are not the same molecule. They're different. You see? They're mirror images of each other, but they're different, and very often they have different chemical properties. Okay? Most often. And so what has happened is, I forget whether it, they say right as... I've got down here, why only right-handed life? That must have been when I was putting the thing together. So, I'm talking to a zoologist about this. So I'm going to assume that life, we'll just say life is right-handed, right? Everything that is alive is right-handed. It's all right-handed. And things that are left-handed, molecules, are either of no benefit to the right-handed life, or they are poisonous to the right-handed life. Now here's an interesting little thing. Someone has been able to develop left-handed sugar. Looks like sugar, tastes like sugar, bakes like sugar, and does not react as a carbohydrate in your body. Goes right through your body without any effect whatsoever. Isn't that wonderful? So all of us sugar addicts, when they're able to mass produce it, which is the problem right now, they can't mass produce it because it's too expensive. But all of us sugar addicts, which I happen to like sugar, will enjoy sugar without having the problem of having any reaction in your body once you can enjoy left-handed sugar. Isn't that fun? But everything is right-handed. Now the problem is, if you've got this primordial soup where these chemical reactions are taking place, why did we end up with everything being right-handed? Why don't we have left-handed life? Why don't we have some things right-handed and some things left-handed? And another problem with that is that in order to produce what a lot of scientists claim to be the first amino acids that could make the building blocks of proteins in a laboratory, so they put amino acids together out of constituents. We'll talk about that later. The problem is that if you don't remove the left-handed molecule from the solution in which the right-handed molecules that are necessary to build those amino acids are present, they tear one another down. And so they had to drain away chemically the left-handed molecules and preserve the right-handed ones in order to build amino acids. That would never have happened. They also removed the energy source, which was electricity. They also had to do that in order to preserve the molecules because the same thing that put them together would also tear them apart if they were left that way. And so, well, we'll talk about that a little bit later, the production of amino acids in the laboratory. But there are lots of problems with that. But why do we have only right-handed life? Why didn't we develop left-handed life, too, if it was all happening by chance in that same primordial soup where both right and left-handed molecules would have been produced? Okay, I'm going to take a break for lunch. Okay, when we left off, we were talking about right-handed and left-handed molecules. And cute little things that they are, you know, right-handed, left-handed molecules. Some experiments were done with a bacterium or bacteria under an electron microscope, and until, you know, things only last so long under an electron microscope, and then they die. Actually, spiders have been found to last about the longest under electron microscopes. I think if we have a nuclear war, at least spiders will be left. And there'll be something left afterwards. The spiders will make it. You know. Cockroaches probably make it too, yeah. That's interesting too. So we'll get to cockroaches later when we talk about the flood. What cockroaches were like before the flood. But they took this bacterium and chemically stripped away part of its cell wall, or part of its wall, and its whatever it was. I don't know whether it was, it must have been just single unicellular rather than multicellular. But stripped away part of it and brought a macromolecule of a left-handed nature close to it, the very constituents of which were needed for its repair. But it was left-handed rather than right-handed. And watched with this macromolecule as the bacterium slowly took the molecule apart, put it back together as a right-handed molecule, and adopted it to itself. It's sort of like the Harvard law of biological experiments. When everything is perfect, all the controls are right, the organism does what it wants. I don't like to see the guy watching over there going, I don't believe that. Did I just see that do that? Okay. It's like the end of the movie Places in the Heart. You sit there staring at the screen going, did I just see that? Wondering what in the world happened in your head. And if you haven't seen it, good movie. Go to see it. Okay, now the next thing we want to discuss is the area of thermodynamics, which we discussed a bit last, actually quite a bit in last lecture. But in the area of thermodynamics, as we said, because of the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, we can see that evolution says exactly what is backwards to the laws of entropy, or the law of entropy, which is that everything is going down, degenerating, going to greater and greater randomness. Evolution says, contrary to that, that everything is going to greater and greater complexity. And so evolution is contrary to the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, saying that everything is going uphill rather than downhill. And as we mentioned before, with respect to origins, why has there not been heat death? Why do we not have a complete steady state or total entropy if the universe has always been running down? And as we mentioned before, to say yet, the universe just hasn't run down yet, presupposes a beginning to the running down. Now, one of the problems with the Earth, that's all we're going to do with the Earth thermodynamics because of the other lecture. If you're listening by tape, that information is on the lecture about naturalism and supernaturalism. We want to talk a little bit about the Earth, whether it's old or young. I think it's interesting, the different dating processes that have been proposed for dating the Earth, old or young. We have the most common of which these days is called radiometric dating. Ah! There you go. Didn't move there. Most common of which is called radiometric dating, different kinds, potassium, argon, strontium, rubidium. What's that? Oh, yeah, okay. Radiometric dating is not when two radiomets go out for a Coke. It's not when two radioisotopes go have a hamburger together. Okay. Radiometric dating would be an interesting idea of dating, wouldn't it? Or nuclear dating. Okay. Radiometric dating is trying to find out what particular age or a particular stratum has in the Earth by the rate of radiometric decay. When you have some radioactive material, the material is giving off portions, usually of its nucleus. When you have radioactive material, it's giving off different portions of the atom. All these things are changing right now. It's hard to say atom, molecule, and so forth when that whole concept is completely changing in quantum physics. So it gives off part of itself, evidently. We seem to be able to trace that. And as it does, it changes then into a different element. And it does that with any particular group or of molecules. It'll do that at a particular rate in reaction to one another as molecules or as atoms. They lose these particles at a particular rate. So it's called the rate of decay. As the radioactive material becomes the non-radioactive material, which is called the sister element. Okay? Now, so then you have one thing a radioactive isotope breaking down into another material. And so you get these different, that's why you hear a dual name, strontium, rubidium, potassium, argon. You hear things like that, or potassium, argon. You hear them break, they break down from one thing to the next, and then because that is a particular rate of decay, it is supposed, now this is something that must be supposed, that if you have a particular amount of radioactive material, that the rate of decay has been constant, and if you can figure out how much radioactive material there is now in ratio with the sister elements, then you should be able to figure out how long it has been breaking down, and that should give you a time to the beginning of the breaking down, which tells you how long or how old this particular thing is that you're dating. In this case, the stratum in which your fossils are found. Now, there are certain things that are assumed. There are certain things that are presupposed in radiometric dating. First of all, two major ones. The first thing is a constant rate of decay. Really interesting, some of the studies that have been done recently where they found two things can change the rate of decay. Interesting. The two things that will change the rate of decay. Take a guess. No, I'm sure God could, but they wouldn't. Water and heat. Yes. Okay. Interesting. You'd have a lot of that at the flood, wouldn't you? Okay. Water and heat. Okay, so it presupposes a constant rate of decay. In other words, it has been breaking down at the same rate through however many billions or millions of years. The material has been breaking down at the same rate of decay, changing from the radioactive material to the non-radioactive material, to the stable material. Now, the second thing that is presupposed is that the beginning of it was pure and not mixed. In other words, they have to presuppose that at the beginning it was all radioactive. All the material was unstable. The reason they have to do that is because which scientist is going to say, when you look back into the past and you don't know how far back to go, which scientist is going to say whether it was 30-70% with the radioactive and the sister material, or whether it was going to be 20-80, or if it was going to be 50-50, if it was going to be 60-40, what was the percentage that you start out with? So the only thing you can really assume to make anything constant is that it was all radioactive at one time and it all had to break down into something else. Because otherwise it's just up to the scientist as to what he wants to start with. And then that won't help you one little bit if you don't start out assuming that everything had to break down. Because if you have 20-80, then the dating on that particular stratum is going to be completely different than if you started out with 60-40. See? Because you have more material. Let's say this is the sister element. You have less material to break down here than you do here. And so that would make the time here longer than this one. And so some of you have maybe read analogies about that concerning apples and oranges and bananas being thrown together at a crash site where three trucks crash. And there are all these apples and oranges and bananas are all over the place. You got to figure out exactly what the percentage was of apples, oranges, and bananas before the trucks crashed. Of course, the problem was that all the apples, oranges, and bananas were not spilled, and the three trucks drove away from the site. And you still got to figure out what the percentage was without knowing how much was in the truck. Okay, let me give you a little simpler illustration of this. Radiometric dating isn't that hard to understand once you apply your mind to the process. But here's an illustration that one guy used that I find very helpful. You walk into an old abandoned house and you find a candle on a table and the candle is lit, it is burning. You observe the candle for a number of hours and you find out that it is now burning at a rate of 1 inch per hour. Question, how long has the candle been burning? And? Right, but that's one point. You don't know how tall it was, which relates to how much radioactive material there was to start with. Okay, how tall the candle was relates to how much radioactive material there was, how big it was, how much there was of this material. Okay, and the second thing was, has it always been burning at 1 inch per hour? Maybe at some time in the past there was a breeze blowing through the house, Maybe somebody came in, snuffed it out for a while. Maybe it got rained on and it burnt, you know, it didn't burn as well for a while. Maybe something happened that it hasn't always been burning that fast or burned faster at some point. And so the thing is, unless you know how tall the candle was to start with and whether or not the rate of decay has been constant, the rate of burning has been constant, you can't tell how long the candle has been burning. But that's exactly what they're trying to do with radiometric dating. They're trying to tell how old the Earth is, or particular parts of the Earth, by saying how long something has been decaying, but they don't know how much radioactive material was there to start with in proportion to the sister element, and they can't say whether or not the rate of decay was constant. And so there are lots of things that are presupposed, but those are the two major things, that make it difficult to tell through radioactive decay exactly how old things are. Now, one of the problems is they found recently that water and heat both change the rate of radioactive decay. And at the flood, we could have had a just complete upset of everything with all that water and all that heat. And you know the geologic column that you see so neatly laid out in biology books or you know whatever. You see this nice neat column that says this was laid down during. They've got all these names. You see, we won't bother with the names. The Triassic and all this kind of stuff. You've got all these different names for the different periods, and they say this was from this year to this year, this was so many millions of years ago, this is so many, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago up at the top. And those things, that whole column, was all worked out before radiometric dating ever came along. It was all worked out. As a matter of fact, before a lot of the fossil evidence that was used to supposedly support the idea, it was already worked out. And how was it worked out? It was worked out according to the idea of evolution rather than from evidence itself. The idea was presupposed, then the ages of the columns were worked out, and then people went to try to find evidence for those things. There were a few things that were around at the time that gave them some kind of idea like that. But other than that, it was really the idea of evolution coming out of process philosophy that really started the whole thing. And so the geologic column and the ages were really worked out before radiometric dating ever came along. And a lot of times in radiometric dating, inconsistencies are completely ignored. When something comes out to read 5,000 years, the person looking at that with other, quote, evidence, namely the theory of evolution, may say, that can't be correct. It could not be just 5,000 years old. And our question is, why not? I question the whole thing of radiometric dating anyway. I don't think it's reliable. But if they're going to use that kind of thing, why couldn't it be 5,000 years old? The reason it couldn't be 5,000 years old is because it doesn't fit their theory. Okay? Not because it could be just 5,000 years old, but because it doesn't fit their theory. Because if it were 5,000 years old, they go, well, it just turns everything upside down. That's like Leakey when he found a modern human skull in Precambrian rock. And he said, no way. There's no way that this could be true, because if it is, and of course he was honest with it, he said, we did find it there. And he said, if this is really true, then we may as well all go out, all our charts are wrong concerning evolution, we may as well all go out and become truck drivers, is what he said. All of us paleontologists, anthropologists may as well become truck drivers, because everything that we have that we've supported has been false. Now, and what happened to skull, was it 1470? 1420? Which one was it? What number was it? 70? 14. So what happened to skull 40? You ever hear about that again? Most of us have never heard about it to start with. What happened to that skull that was found in Precambrian rock? We don't hear about it. Yeah. It's around somewhere. They've got it. I'm sure they got it labeled and stashed away in a little vault someplace. Okay. So then, let's look at a few processes that favor a young Earth rather than an old Earth. Some processes, we'll look at six of them. And there are lots of them, actually. One of them is gravitational decrease. Since the last century, we've been monitoring the rate of gravitational decrease in the Earth. The amount of gravity on the Earth has been decreasing at basically a steady rate. And if you take this, what's that? Oh, yeah, because it's been getting light. Everything's been getting lighter and lighter. Yeah, don't expect to lose a whole bunch of weight overnight tonight because your scales will be different. That's not working like that. A little bit at a time, though, the gravitational pull of the Earth has been decreasing, and if see, it's like this, you put it on a chart, and they followed it, it had a few little inconsistencies, so they follow it down, and if you trace that back and go back, you can only go back about 10,000 years, and the pull of the gravity on the Earth would have been so heavy that it would have crushed the crust of the Earth. So you can only go back about that far. You cannot go back 10 billion years or 5 billion years or even a few million years. You can only go back a few thousand years before you have trouble with the gravitational increase. Second thing is sediment on the ocean floors. After millions of years, why don't we find more sediment from the oceans on the ocean floors than we do? People were expecting it to be very, very deep, and it is not. And things settling out of the oceans, being washed down through the whole process of erosion and taken off to the sea and taken out by rivers, should have put a whole lot of stuff in the oceans that it has not. Related to that, number three, is the content or the percentage of minerals in ocean water. Why have the oceans not yet reached complete saturation after millions of years of this whole process of things being dissolved in water? Why are the mineral, there's very little percentage of mineral compared to the actual amount of water. And so why then is there not a heavier concentration, if not complete concentration, of minerals in the ocean water? Number four is, related to number two, by the way, at the mouths of rivers, there should be an awful lot more sediment than there is. That's related to number two, sediment on ocean floors. The mouths of rivers are a real problem with some scientists. Number four, population increase. If you take, given all the wars on everything that we've had, take the and diseases and famines and that kind of stuff, take the population increase, it should have been much greater than it is already. We should have come to these almost exponential growth population increase. We should have reached it much sooner than we have. Okay, so number four is population increase. In other words, the amount of people that there are in the Earth seem to indicate that we've been around that long. With all of these things, you can only go back a few thousand years, like 6 to 10,000 years, and that's all that it seems to admit. Number five is the movement of the moon. The moon is gradually moving away from the Earth. The Earth, you get the moon. And the moon is gradually moving away from the Earth. You get the orbit of the moon around the Earth. And there is what is called, because of the guy that figured it out, the Roche limit, R-O-C-H-E. This guy figured out that if the moon is moving out from the Earth, you can only take that back to a certain distance from the Earth, and if you take it back that far, the gravitational pull of the Earth would have torn the moon to shreds. Okay? And so that's called the Roche limit. That's the closest the moon could have been without being torn apart by the gravitational pull of the Earth or being pulled in and demolished. Okay? So then the moon, as it is moving away, if you measure this distance right here, according to the speed at which the moon is moving away from the Earth, you can only go back 6 to 10,000 years and it would reach the Roche limit. And so it's another thing that indicates that the Earth and the moon have not been around all that long. Now, see, another question there is, people bring up this question all the time. They say, aren't you being unfair now using the scientists' idea of uniformitarianism to show a young age for the Earth? No, I'm not being unfair. Because they are the ones who presuppose it. And what I'm doing is saying, even using their system, you cannot say that the Earth is as old as they say it is. Even using their own system, you cannot say that. There's just too much evidence against that. I am not saying that the Earth has always been moving away from the moon has always been moving away from the Earth at that speed. We cannot guarantee that the rate of movement away from the Earth is constant like that. But even using their own constant rate, we can't say that. We can't say that the Earth is millions of years old because the moon would not have existed as it does. And number six is the amount of dust on the moon that has been collected on the moon. You know why the first landing modules had such wide pads on them? Because they were expecting this moon to be covered with about 20 feet of dust. And when they got there, they found out it was more like about a quarter of an inch. And that was a big problem for them, because they were really expecting it to be very, very deep. They were afraid the guy was going to have trouble when he first stepped out of the module. And they found out that it was only about a quarter of an inch. And that did not fit their ideas of how old the universe is, because if the moon has been collecting dust at the rate that it is now, if it's been collecting dust for a million years, it should have been much deeper than what it is on the moon. So what did they do? They just said, well, we must be wrong about how fast the dust is collecting on the moon. They just changed their idea of the rate of collection. Okay? I wonder what happened with their other experiments that showed how fast it was collecting. Okay. That's all you can do with science when the facts don't agree. You just have to change your theory. Now, why then do we have the appearance of age? Why do we have the appearance of age in the creation? Some people would say, isn't God involved in deception if there is the appearance of age in the earth or in the universe? Well, there are things like, first of all, the whole process of creating something, creating anything that is going to go on as a process is a problem. Can you start a natural process at the beginning of the process? Just think about that. Can you start a natural process at the beginning of the process and have it continue? Let me ask a question. If you have the process of trees producing seeds which produce trees, where can you break into that process, if it's going to continue, that it would not look as if it's always been going on? See, if you have a seed, if I say, look, a seed, and God made a seed that was it's only been made for 30 seconds, what would it look like to you? Okay? So you can't break with a natural process. The only thing you can do is when you make it, it will look as if the thing has been going on for a while. If somebody walked up to Adam right after he was created and said, well, let's say this guy was a physiologist in human anatomy, and he comes up and he goes, well, quite a specimen here, looks pretty good. Where's his belly button? Okay, looks pretty good. Only problem here is how old are you? And Adam goes, by my cosmic clock here, I would say I'm probably about 60 seconds. And you go, can't be 60 seconds. You have to be at least 30. You have to be at least 25, something like that. You know, it checks out his sternum to find out if it's connected to his, collarbone to find out if it's connected to his sternum and so forth. You've got to be at least 30 years old. I mean, your collarbone's connected to your sternum. And, okay. Because about 25 to 30 is when your collarbone eventually connects, fuses to your sternum, and so you can date skeletons and stuff like that. Anyway, in case you didn't know that. And so, sore right there, my exercises or something. And so this guy thinks that Adam must be at least 30 years old. And he goes, no, a minute and a half now, as you've been philosophizing for the last 30 seconds. And so Adam, when he was made, had to look as if he had come from someplace else. He had to look as if he had been from either birth, which he maybe didn't look like. I don't know about the belly button thing. I don't think that's so important. Whether he looked like that or not doesn't make any difference. But he did look as if he was about maybe 25, 30, or 40 years old. See? He had to be an adult. Why? Because the process would not go on if God had started out with a baby and there was nobody to take care of the baby. Because the baby would have died. Right? Unless God supernaturally intervened in that, and then you have nothing different than God took care of the baby until the baby was an adult, and that was how the process started. So it doesn't make any difference. Either way, it has to look. Even if you start with a baby, it looks as if it was born. Right? As if it were born. So then, Adam, the stars are another problem. The stars are another problem. If you've got light traveling at a particular speed, and we estimate or calculate that the stars are approximately, some of them, 4 million or 5 billion light years away, then light couldn't have been, that light could not have reached us unless the universe has been around for that long. You get the idea? We would not be seeing the light from some of these things that are that far away. We would not be seeing the light yet. It would not have reached us yet. Now, of course, there are a number of ways of explaining that. First of all, if God could create, and He did create, the stars to be lights upon the earth, He could obviously, as a process, just as He could create something right in the middle of the process so that it would function correctly, in other words, trees, whatever, He could just as well make the star and all of the light in between, so that it would be functioning as a process to give light on the earth. No problem if He's going to make a star to be able to make all the light in between. But even disregarding that, there are some other things that you have to consider. And that is the way that we try to figure out where stars are, how far away they are. You cannot measure in space. You can only calculate, because nobody can get out with a yardstick and figure out how far it is to the moon. Okay, or to the nearest star. And so you have to calculate. And here's the way it's done. The sun, there's the sun and the orbit of the earth. Yeah, it's called parallax. And you've got a star out here. And what they do is take a sighting on this star, like this, and they wait 6 months, when the earth is over here, take another sighting on the star, and then use this line across here as the baseline of your triangle, and then measure this angle, and then they're able to figure out what the altitude is. Got the idea? If you know what this distance is, and you know what these two angles are, then you know where that is. Got the idea? Okay. The problem with that is when you reach a ratio of 28.5 to 1, that's supposed to be a 1, 28.5 to 1, that's an altitude to baseline ratio, that if this is 28.5 inches long, and this down here is only 1 inch, the angle, see this right here, reaches 89 degrees. And you go from 89 degrees, and you have to go into seconds and minutes and seconds of a degree, and you get into even a lot smaller things than that when you're trying to figure out how far a star is away. So what happens is, this angle right here is so close to 90 degrees that it's almost up to the mathematician to try to figure out whether it is 90 degrees or it is less than 90 degrees. And a lot of it becomes guesswork. And that's why some astronomers are saying, this very possible, see, these are so close to parallel in many cases because it appears to be 90 degrees. Can't write very well that direction. They're so close to parallel that the question is there anything, is it parallel or is it not? It's almost a guess. And some astronomers, oddly enough, are even saying that the universe could be only 200 light years across. That could be the extent of it.